What does innovation sound like? It sounds like the luxury of being in the moment with your customer, client, or patient. It sounds like having the right information right when you need it. It sounds like being at your best for your customers and your business. Thanks to Hyland's intelligent content solutions that improve digital processes, innovators everywhere are able to do their thing better, whatever that thing is. Now, who doesn't like the sound of that? Hyland, for innovators everywhere. Visit Hyland.com.
The Future Proof Podcast from Newstalk.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland. Hashtag believe in science.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof the Podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. If you'd like to feel the dopamine squirt of having your name called out in the program, you can email us at science@newstalk.com. You can also find us on Twitter. We're at @NewstalkScience. We get to your comments from last week at the end of the podcast. Coming up on this week's program, the technological revolution in medicine is happening on so many fronts. Take wearables, personal genomics, AI, and big data. What will happen when these technologies fully converge? Will we finally welcome in the era of predictive medicine, where we're told to take a pill even before we get sick? Will we cure aging? The future of medicine is on Future Proof in a few minutes' time. First, though, it's time to look back at the week's science news. And joining me via Skype is Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD and from DCU, Dr. Susan Kelleher. You're both very welcome. Our first story. Shane, has to do with frog robots.
Yes, the whole idea of animal robots. When I read this first, I actually read it twice thinking, is this an April Fool's joke? But it's not. There is a whole area of research that's very established. And this is a paper from Science published this week. A cellular platform for the development of living machines. Can you imagine? And we talked previously about how robot swarms can be made using synthetic or artificial materials. We've also talked about how you can build very, very complicated scaffolds and put living cells onto them in order to make machines. But this is new. What this paper has done is they've shown that they're able to get biomaterials to themselves form useful structures without any scaffolds.
What are they using? They're using presumably individual cells one by one?
Yes, absolutely. And they put them in, they're able to stimulate them. They're very responsive, these amphibian cells, they're frog cells. And they can, they've reported a method for the generation of these biological robots. And so that's the new thing, is this how they're able to take those cells, stimulate them in various ways, and then they self-assemble into robots. Which kind of is terrifying. So these are xenorobots, and they show coordinated movement. So they have this swarm behavior. Very interestingly, there's no complex genomics going on here. They don't have to edit things at that level, which means this is a very easy method to reproduce and low cost.
Well, some cost to the frogs.
Well, they're not using frogs.
The ultimate price.
So it's important to say that there's, like, you know, because other papers have talked about how you could take cockroaches and kind of wire them up to get them to do things.
They have wired cockroaches up.
But this is perhaps ethically a little bit safer than that, because they're just using cells, you know, like, you know, you can take, say, like some cells off a frog and the frog is fine as a result. We haven't really asked the frog. So the biorobots that are reported in this paper, they arise by cellular self-organization. Now, it's important to say that they're not conscious, right? So cellular self-organization is just working off very simple forces that physicists and chemists would be very used to, like van der Waals or surface tension or things like that, that are able to kind of push and pull forces that are working on this cellular level. And they respond to stimuli like light, chemical, and surgical. So you can poke them and they'll move.
As you said, there's no neurons involved in this. There's no brain. There's no system by which anything can feel anything. And of course, the cells, I was joking, but those cells that come from the frog can then be cultured, presumably to build more frogs. So it's only one frog donated some cells, presume in theory, is my understanding.
Yeah. What I think what's cool at the end of this paper, it's a science paper. So as Susan had noted, you have to throw everything into a science paper, you know, years of work. They go as far as to show a proof of principle for writable molecular memory. But that's really cool. So you could program these swarms to do things. And that's very interesting for people who are working in biomedicine or bioengineering. And when these things are finished doing their job, they can disintegrate and they're gone, you know, as in like they'll decay like any other biomaterials. You're not left with synthetic materials or plastics in either within you or within the environment. So very, very cool. However, I am terrified at the idea of living robots, I suppose.
Well, it comes back to that old question of what is life, isn't it? And no, I don't want an answer, Shane.
I don't have one.
Time for it. We haven't got time for it.
I have famously messed up on that numerous times.
Susan, our second story has to do with regrowing teeth.
So this is a really interesting story because as life expectancy gets longer, we're going to be looking for ways to make sure that our bodies can keep up with us and keep going as well. However, teeth were not designed to last 100 years. And as you know, once you lose a tooth, they don't regrow. But scientists around the world are looking at a preemptive medicine which could be used to help regrow teeth when they need replacing. And a team from Japan, this seems to be very important in Japan's strategy for aging populations. And it's very interesting that there's a lot of work going on there in this area. They recently published this work in Science Advances where they've shown that they can regenerate teeth in mice, which is phenomenal. They genetically engineered mice to have some teeth missing. And then they gave them doses of an antibody that caused the inhibition of a gene called USAG1. And this group has previously shown that by inhibiting this, you can show an enhancement in bone production protein called BMP, and it increased growth factors in the bone around teeth. And so when they gave the doses to these mice that had these teeth missing, two things happened. First, it caused the offspring of the mice to have all their teeth. So the gene fixed itself, and then the offspring had teeth. Wow. And second of all, direct application to the area of the missing tooth on these mice caused the tooth regeneration to occur.
Wow.
That's mad. Yeah.
And so do you think this would work if you got your teeth pulled because of decay, that you might just like use an eyedropper, drop a bit of this in, and then like magic beanstalk, the next day you've got teeth?
Yeah, I don't know if it's going to be that fast, but this is what they're proposing. Unfortunately, this USA gene, one gene, is also involved in a lot of other things in the body. So they have to be very, very careful that if they knock that out, then other things might go wrong. So we're very far away from sort of using this in humans, but the fact that they can do this in mammals, and then that they can do this in a way that the offspring, you know, that they might make stronger sort of offspring in terms of, you know, evolution, and to be able to fix, say, problems within the host, and then their offspring sort of don't have those issues. I think it's really, I don't know, very promising and something I hadn't really thought about. So it's nice to know someone did.
Well, it is nice to have a full set of teeth. Interesting. Our third story, Shane, has to do with eating quickly. This is something I do. There's a phrase in Great Expectations where young Pip is scolded for bolting his food. And I remember reading it and saying, that's exactly what I do. I bolt my food. And I really shouldn't. Anyway, it's not good for us, is it?
How learned you are, Jonathan. Great Expectations. There you go.
You know me.
Between your wine tasting and your reading up. So this is a publication in the Journal of Clinical Obesity, work done in the United Kingdom. And they've shown an association between the number of siblings, one's birth order in a family, your eating rate, and adiposity, that's excess body fat. And so they've shown this for both adults and children. So they had two separate groups, one in Bristol, one in London, with children and adults, who all self-reported their eating rate, which you've talked about, the number of siblings that they have, and their position in the family, as in their birth order. And then they all had to have their BMIs and their waistlines measured in a controlled way. And they found, this is just a correlation, I have to stress, that people who eat faster have a larger waist size or a higher BMI, right? They also found that firstborn children were twice as likely to eat faster compared with children who are not firstborn. They found that only child families eat the slowest. And they found that in general, this is a sort of some evidence kind of thing, that if you have lots of siblings, you eat at a faster rate. And so that's very interesting. And the paper shows that this is quite a strong correlation. And in their discussion section, they go on to talk about, well, how do you deal with this? And they also talk about the context. So 1/5 of children living in England and the United States, I assume it's similar here, are living with obesity. You notice I use the term living with obesity and as opposed to they are obese. And that's conscious because recently the European Commission have diagnosed obesity as an actual disease, a non-communicable disease. And that has implications for how we treat it and how we deal with it. And indeed, UCD is part of a huge European project looking at ways to help healthcare professionals work with people who are living with obesity. One thing they found here is that distractions don't help when you're eating. So if you're eating whilst you're watching the television, or if you're eating, Jonathan, whilst you're playing a computer game, that can sort of interfere with your natural satiety response. So your body telling you you're full. Yeah. It also says in the paper, if you eat fast foods, high energy density foods, that you will tend to eat faster as well. And we know that both of those are associated with the person having excess body fat. So yeah,
it's always difficult retrofitting reasons to science, right? But it makes sense that if you're eating quickly, your body hasn't told you you're full yet, and so you eat more. And if you're not paying attention to something, you're going to eat more. It doesn't surprise me at all that eating quickly makes you more overweight. Our final story, Susan, is an interesting one. This is about genes that come to life after death.
Yeah, I mean, this was totally unexpected when I read this. It's research from the University of Illinois in Chicago, where they've been investigating what happens to brain cells after we die, as you said. And of course, largely, it's given in the scientific world that cells begin to shut down when the blood supply is cut off from the brain. But in this work, which was published this week in Nature Scientific Reports, shows that the glial cells, a certain cell in your brain, actually come back to life several hours after death. And what's really interesting about this study is the type of tissue that they looked at. So they looked at samples of brain tissue that were collected during routine brain surgery. And very often in this studies of brain tissue, they're usually carried out post-mortem. So sort of like maybe 24 hours later, but these guys got fresh off the, you know, table brain and looked at what's happening to the cells. And they looked at the activity of all the different types of brain cells over the next 24 hours. And about 80 of the genes that were in there, the so-called housekeeping genes, they just remained stable. They didn't change over 24 hours. A second group, which is the one that's responsible for thinking and seizures and what I suppose makes us human, rapidly decreased. Very quickly, they started to shut down. And then finally, the third set of genes that you mentioned, they actually started to increase in activity. So they came from the glial cells, and they're the ones that are involved with cleaning up in the brain after injuries like oxygen deprivation or stroke happen. And so it was really interesting because, as I said, usually they don't get a hold of these types of cells. And for neurodegenerative diseases or neurological disorders, you don't get brain cells live. You know, you only ever get them once the patient has passed away. So to be able to study and get an understanding of what's actually happening in the brain in those first few hours is very important for research into brain disorders, because you need a baseline to say, okay, this is what brain cells are like, and then this is what's going to happen sort of over the course of the time of death. So it'll give us a good indication or more information about what's happening to the brain to be able to understand how these disorders occur.
So what's really interesting to me about this is that in 2009, there were scientists looking at fMRI machines, and they wanted to test and find a baseline. So they put a salmon, a dead salmon, in the machine, And then they recorded that there was some brain activity. And so they said, wait a second, don't read too much into fMRI, because this salmon is dead and clearly there couldn't be any brain activity. But turns out that even after we're dead, there is some sort of brain activity, which again brings us back to that question of what is life, Shane? And I think when we think about it, if we look at different international jurisdictions, we see that you could be dead according to the rules in one country, so brain death, and not dead in the rules of another country where it's cardiac arrest. So this idea of death being a final point, a single line in the timeline of our lives is a bit blurry. Really interesting.
Yeah, and you can go back to your Dickensian novel. That's why Frankenstein was written, and Mary Shelley's parents were scientists. So it all connects.
Amazing. Amazing work, everybody. High five, team. Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD and Dr. Susan Keller from DCU. Thanks, as always. All right, coming up, precision medicine and the end of illness. Medicine is undergoing an extended multi-frontal technological revolution, and some of the things that it promises probably won't deliver, but lots and lots of new developments are leading to extraordinary discoveries and cures for sometimes what used to be incurable. So what might the future of medicine look like? And should we be wary of any of it? James Templeton is digital editor at Wired UK and author of The Future of Medicine, How We Will Enjoy Longer, Healthier Lives. He joins me now. James, I mean, the thing about technology, of course, is that it enhances so many things in medicine. And it's not like we're applying one sort of technology to one medical therapy. We're applying a whole suite of technological tools to a whole range of medical therapies, operations and cures.
Absolutely right. I mean, right now we're living through a bit of a global experiment, right? The COVID-19 pandemic has in a way shown the future of medicine and what is possible when we adopt technologies and scientific research that's been ongoing for many decades and really, really accelerate it. So we've been able to develop not just one or two very successful vaccine candidates inside a year. We've been able to develop dozens, and there'll be dozens more to follow as we keep on top of new variants. And the development of the vaccine is just one part of a global collaboration to make sure that we can get ourselves out of this mess that to an extent we've got ourselves into. In the early days of the pandemic, we were able to sequence the genetic information about this virus within days. We've got an understanding of how it affects the body, not just organ by organ, but cell by cell. This is a disease that we know inside out, and we will beat this thing, and we'll beat it because we're pretty clever. And the future of medicine is about these huge strides that we've made over the last several decades finally coming to fruition as we move from treating disease to maintaining health. And that's the really, really big difference that we're going to see over the coming years.
One of the things that's been thrown up is the variability of reaction to this particular disease. And I suppose the most exciting thing for me in terms of medicine that is just within our reach is this concept of precision medicine. Can you tell us a little bit about what that means and what it might mean for treating rare conditions or things like a pandemic in the future?
Yeah, absolutely. We've seen throughout the pandemic that you can take two people who on the face of it look identical. So to take myself as an example, a white British male, aged between 30 and 40, I could walk into a hospital with quite severe COVID and walk out several days later having recovered. Someone else with the exact same race, age, BMI, height, you name it, might not walk out again because there's something going on in their body that dictates that the virus is going to take a much greater toll on them. And we can understand why that's happening. The problem is, at the moment, a lot of our interactions with the healthcare system don't allow medical professionals to collect the information that would help them make those insights. So let's take a visit to the doctor, for an example. So in the UK, I think the average GP appointment lasts about 11 minutes. During that time, they might take your blood pressure, your temperature, they might take a urine sample, fairly basic stuff. And they'll be doing that based on your medical history and what you tell them. Well, first thing, you've gone in because you feel unwell, so that's not great. It's already too late potentially to get ahead of this problem. But also they'll be making assumptions based on population averages. They're not treating you as an individual, even if it feels a bit like they are. They're treating you based on a best guess. That's been fine up until this point. But if we really want to unlock the potential of technology and science, what we need to do is move to precision medicine. And precision medicine will allow us to be preventative. So rather than you going into the doctor because you're ill, you might get a ping on your phone saying, it's time for you to start taking this drug, or we want you to start doing these tests at home that you can post back the results to us, and we'll put in place a healthcare plan for you that will ensure you don't get sick, you don't develop diabetes, you don't develop another condition that's going to have a really, really profound impact on your quality of life.
Yeah, we're hearing sort of anecdotal stories of this happening already with Apple Watch and its measurements of heart rates that you can choose to do with a watch and have it constantly monitor your heart rate. How close are we to seeing things like that go one step further? I mean, there's one or two of these sort of sensors, but it would be great to have some sort of wearable biomarker sensor for blood or something like that. Is that very far in the future, the idea that we might be constantly screened for disease or inflammation?
They already exist, and there's some research that's ongoing that hopes that it's possible to detect someone who doesn't have symptoms of COVID-19 but is infected using nothing more than a fitness tracking, health tracking wearable like an Apple Watch. It's believed that there may be signs that can be picked up to suggest that you are infected. So there is promise already. The mistake that people make when they think about the future of medicine is we're all going to constantly be walking around with an array of sensors on our body, in our body, data flowing out of us on an almost constant basis. That might be the case in some situations, but what's more likely to happen is your genome will be sequenced at or before birth, and that will give a really, really useful baseline for understanding who you are and why you might be well or why you might get sick. And then on top of that, we'll collect really, really detailed data about all the other facets of our body as well. So our microbiome is something that your listeners will be quite familiar with. So a greater understanding of each individual's microbiome will be very useful for making sure that we can prevent those individuals from getting ill. So rather than our bodies being constantly tracked, there might be moments within our lives where we submit huge quantities of data to the healthcare systems we rely on. And then there are maybe specific periods in our life where we do wear trackers for continuous monitoring. So when you get to a certain age, or if you're exhibiting certain symptoms of a particular disease, it might be that you're sent at-home testing kits and a variety of trackers and wearables that help the medical professionals who are going to treat you really, really understand what's going on inside your body. Now, ideally, it wouldn't come to that point where you do get ill, and it would be all preventative. And in order for that to be the case, we would need to have this continuous data feed coming out of people. That's not necessarily impossible, but in terms of rolling that out across the entire world, that's a long way in the future.
Yeah, I mean, the future of medicine is quite broad, but you must have come across some innovations or some science that leads us to a very interesting place in terms of diagnostics. Did you come across something that you thought, this is straight out of Star Trek?
What's brilliant about the future of medicine, certainly all the phenomenally intelligent people that I spoke to for the book who are really pushing the frontiers of what we're able to do, is that the work is quite humble. It's kind of alluring, some of the stuff that maybe comes out of Silicon Valley, where you've got phenomenally rich people and companies with a lot of venture capital money behind them trying to cure death or solve the problem of aging. What's more realistic to think is that, let's say the average human being lives for 80 to 90 years. That's sort of life expectancy in most developed countries, somewhere in that range. Now, a lot of people who live to that age might not be very healthy for the last 20 or so or 30 or so years of their lives. A number of people in my family and friendship groups, elderly relatives, have gotten to that age and they start getting diseases and their body kind of really goes through it. And by the time they sadly pass away, they've had one or two or three or four diseases that have really taken a chunk out of them. And their quality of life in those last 20 to 30 years isn't particularly great. So a huge breakthrough in medicine will be not to end aging or enable us to live for 500 years, but to increase our health span. And there's phenomenal potential here. So most people are healthy for 60 to 70 years, and then they live for a number of years with a number of diseases, which make living quite hard. And on the economy, that's quite a burden as well, which is important to consider. So what we might be able to do if we're able to treat aging as a disease, and there's a lot of very smart people who believe we can, is increase your health span so that you live for 80, 90, 100, 110 years and you drop dead. You don't get ill. You don't get lots of diseases. You live a long, healthy life. And that is very much within our grasp. There are researchers out there who have identified the biomarkers of longevity. So there are cohorts of patients who, for some reason, live to 100, 110, and then just die. And they don't get any diseases, there's nothing wrong with them, and they just have a whopping great big heart attack in their sleep or whatever, and they sadly pass away. But they were never blighted by disease. Now, we've identified a number of the biomarkers of longevity, and it's now potentially possible to develop drugs, treatments that people could take. So it might be the case in the very near future that you take a pill a day from a certain age, and that's the pill that you take to fight aging. And it doesn't mean that you can live forever, but it means that when you get to 80, you can still go on that round the world holiday that you'd always wanted to do.
Yeah, and it's interesting because while on a population level, general medical advice is, of course, eat healthy, exercise and so on, there are really good examples of some of the oldest living people alive today who absolutely don't do that and are perfectly fine. You talk about the Kahn siblings in your book, and they're a fascinating example of maybe the exception that proves the rule, or the potential if you have the right genome to do whatever you want and die in your sleep.
Yeah, a lot of the future of medicine is unlocking things that our body already knows. A lot of the secrets that we need to uncover to make big medical advances lie within the bodies of people who are alive today or have passed away and have become sort of fascinating research potential for medical science. So the Kahn siblings that you mentioned there are the world's oldest living quartet of siblings. So Helen Kahn was 109 when she passed away. Her brother Peter was 103. Their brother Irving was 109. And the youngest was 101 when she passed away, Leonore. And there's been a lot written about the Kahn siblings over the years because they're deeply fascinating. But when they were born, life expectancy was something like 40 years in the United States. They all lived beyond the age of 100, and it wasn't because they lived lives of virtue and good health. Helen, for example, who died aged 109, smoked all day, every day for more than 90 years. And when she was asked, "Why didn't you stop?" her answer was, "All the doctors that told me to died before I did." Irving worked beyond his 100th birthday as an investor on Wall Street. And his son, Thomas, who also works at the same investment firm, once said that his father's diet was lamb chops one night and steak the next. So these people weren't making lifestyle choices that would suggest that they should live very, very long, healthy lives. But what they did have is the biomarkers of longevity. So they were born with a genetic advantage. And by understanding what that genetic advantage is, we might pretty soon be able to develop medicines, and that there are medicines that already exist that might soon be entering medical trials that would allow all of us to unlock some of the benefits of these biomarkers of longevity and ensure that we're able to live the lives that we want to live and still live long, healthy lives, not blighted by disease.
It sounds like you're saying the idea of solving aging is not that far away from us.
So in terms of solving aging, I think what's very, very possible is in the medium term future that we will shift to a preventative model of medicine, that medicine will be more personalized, that our healthcare systems will have a really, really rich understanding of who we all are as individuals. There's been extensive scientific research to show that the physical limit of a human life is around 120 years, 130 years. We wouldn't ever expect to live beyond that. We're spent when we get to that age, and something will get us. Our bodies are just done. There's only so many beats our heart can make. But what we can do is find very, very affordable, very, very successful ways of increasing people's health span to make sure that they live as many years as possible in really, really good health. And by expanding even the most basic access to medical care across the world, you know, this isn't an even game that that we're playing. Even in rural communities versus urban communities in developed nations, access to quality medical care is not an even game. So by rolling out the advantages that we already take for granted in many developed countries into less developed countries, that will unlock huge potential. And then on top of that, if we can apply personalized precision medicine and make that scalable and affordable, then it needn't be the case that people spend many years of their lives in really quite ill health.
Well, it's a very optimistic view of the future. It's not one that's often painted in science fiction films, but I'll sign up to it. James Templeton is digital editor at Wired UK and author of The Future of Medicine, How We Will Enjoy Longer, Healthier Lives. James, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
The thing about sci-fi is it always seems so far away, but if you look at how medicine has jumped up in terms of what we're able to do now compared to even just 20 years ago, it's mind-boggling, the advances that we've made. And so that sort of Star Trek scenario is happening. It's just we're in it. So it doesn't seem like it's happening as fast as it is. Right, as always, it's time to look back at some of your texts and tweets from last week. And we were talking about a science experiment to send a Chateau Petrus wine from France into space to see what happens to it. And Shane, quite rightly, said this sounds like a bit of a PR stunt. Indeed it did. Someone says, is brandy a wine? I mean, no. It's brandy, isn't it? I don't know. Maybe it is. Is this a trick question? Is this an April Fool's? Because I'm recording this. You don't know. It wasn't texted in then. Maybe they knew I would read it out on the 1st of April. I don't know. On generational trauma, we were speaking about this last week. Fascinating speaking with Rob Dias. This idea that you could have this horrible event in your life, some traumatic event, you know, whether it's famine, abuse, or Holocaust, something like that. And that would actually have a way of transmitting down through generations and not just through genes or markers on those genes called epigenetics. But also through other ways, culturally. Really interesting chat. Someone says that people living in Palestine or Syria or Yemen are never mentioned when you speak of trauma. Well, look, the Holocaust wasn't my example in the first place. It would seem a bit weird to say, oh, well, don't forget about the Palestinians and the Syrians. I mean, obviously, anybody going through something traumatic like the settlements in the West Bank, being in constant fear of your life, war-torn Syria, of course that sort of trauma will be the same sort of trauma, will have the same sort of implications, presumably, as the Holocaust. I'm not weighing one against the other, Jews against Arabs. That would be ridiculous. It was just a reference to the sort of thing that scientists can say, this happened, and we can measure then, you know, what the changes are from one generation to the next. I mean, if the implication is, you know, why don't you mention the plights of Arabs and Muslims more, this is not a conscious thing in particular. But I don't know, maybe there's a point in that. Maybe we shouldn't always reference that. But I mean, in this case, it wasn't my particular choice. So I don't know. And finally, we were talking about the evolution of deliciousness, and Rob Dunn came on the program talking about how our taste evolved. Someone texted in saying, something is off. Your guest mentioned smell. I'm on blood thinner medications and I'm experiencing a strange sweet smell as I breathe. Well, I'll start by saying I'm not a doctor, and I'll finish by saying I'm not a doctor. But maybe the medication is in glucose. Maybe the condition that you're you're taking the meds for is causing you to sense a sweetness, or maybe someone just put flowers in your room that you haven't noticed yet. Again, I'm not a doctor. And that's it from us for this week's Future Proof. We'll be back next Tuesday in your podcast feed with Future Proof Extra, in which we speak to a scientist who is measuring how long it takes for a bee to vomit. We'll be asking him why. Thanks to Aidan McKelvey, who is producing, Steve Daunt, Garrett Mahal, Simon Keane, and Steve McLoone, who's on sound. Have a great Easter, everyone.